From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour is made in the desert, more specifically, the so-called food desert. It's a term used for areas where there's not access to quality food. You just think about areas where usually we're talking about spaces where there's not a grocery store for a certain amount of miles. But while we've heard a lot about food deserts, we're hearing more now about food swamps. And that's a term that refers to the availability of some food, but low-quality, high-calorie food, fast food, junk food. According to the Atlantic Monthly, new research suggests food deserts might not be the culprit, or at least not the only one, for the high prevalence of obesity in some areas. Instead, food swamps could be to blame. And the Atlantic turns to a study published in the International Journal of Environmental Research and Public Health, where researchers from the University of Connecticut's Rudd Center for Food Policy and Obesity compared the obesity rate of U.S. counties to their ratio of fast food restaurants and convenience stores to grocery stores and supermarkets. Their level of food swampiness, the Atlantic said. And the food swamps had about 4 unhealthy options for each 1 healthy one. Food swamps were a strong predictor of obesity rates. Even stronger than the food deserts were. And, you know, I think it's important to kind of slow down, pull back, and talk about what do we know from the data, what don't we know, and what should we do about this? One of the newest members of Rochester City Council is a man who's worked on this issue for a number of years now, and that's Mitch Gruber. He's FoodLink Chief Program Officer and a new member of Rochester City Council. Mitch, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
And Julia Tedesco is FoodLink Executive Director. Julia, welcome to you as well.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Deserts, swamps. I know you read the article in the Atlantic Monthly. Listeners, we'll share it if you want to check it out yourself. Mitch, what's the first takeaway for you as you look at Rochester, your role both with FoodLink and City Council, and understanding what's a food desert, what's a food swamp?
Well, let me start by talking about the connection that brought Julie and I together, which was Tom Ferraro about 10 years ago. And Tom had been talking about food swamps even when we started working with him. Mm-hmm. This is not news to anyone, I think, to anyone in the field, I should say.
Yeah.
I think what it is an appropriate reframing of the problem for the public. A food desert really refers to a place where there's no food. Right? I mean, that's the terminology desert suggests lack of rain, right?
Yep.
Look around the city of Rochester, look around almost any rural community that we serve at FoodLink as well. You won't find a food desert. There's always places that sell food. What the swamp alludes to is what is the quality of the food? What is, frankly, the diversity of the food? Because I think what we all know about, you know, and I'm not a geologist by any stretch of the imagination, but we typically see the strongest ecosystems in places where there's a diversity of wildlife, right? There's a diversity of many different things. In a lot of the neighborhoods that have previously called food deserts, there's no diversity of food. It's all high processed, very caloric, nutrient devoid processed foods, which are contributing to obesity rates. And this article really just explains that a little bit further.
Okay. And Mitch, does this article, is it too hard on corner stores, for example, which come up in Rochester a lot? Or is that fair?
Yeah, I think it's fair. I think that, you know, the corner stores across the country in urban areas are selling products that are high margin and easy to sell. And the classic example goes back to, you know, cigarettes, right? When your store is out of cigarettes, Philip Morris or whoever else is knocking at your door to fill up your cigarettes. When you're out of lottery tickets, New York State Lotto is coming there to fill up your scratch-offs. But when you're out of something like a cucumber or out of something like lettuce, there is not that same type of distribution network to be able to sell that stuff. Plus, it spoils. You know, a Twinkie will sit on a shelf for probably 3 millennia and no one would know the difference.
Yes.
And that's not the case with any fresh piece of produce. So it takes a lot more work, it's lower margin, and therefore the corner stores haven't really been interested in selling it.
Okay, and Julia, how do you view FoodLink's role in this kind of conversation as we talk food desert, food swamps?
I think our role over the past several years has sort of to disrupt the normal food system and to look beyond the current options of normal food retail or just simple food, charitable food distribution. Another thing Tom taught us and something we repeat all the time is that charitable food distribution does not solve food insecurity. And neither does the current retail market, the corner stores that are saturating the city. And so there needs to be another option. And we've seen that other attempts at solving this, at putting new grocery stores, sometimes haven't worked. And so what FoodLink is doing is to look beyond charitable food distribution, to look at the current, look beyond the current food distribution models and to create a new one. And the best example of that is curbside market, where we've created new retail opportunities in food deserts, food swamps, whatever you want to call them, in an effort to make it more of a, and this is, you know, another term that's being coined lately, a more of a food oasis, a place where there's options, where there's an abundance of healthy food, affordable food. And in doing so, we've really moved beyond the confines of normal food banking. Our job is to make sure that everyone has access to healthy food. And we do that, you know, beyond just supporting pantries and soup kitchens. We do that by really getting into neighborhoods and changing the landscape.
Sure enough, as I got ready for this program, I heard a couple people say to me, oh, the food desert thing, Constantino's. Mm-hmm. You know, this community still is thinking about that failure of Constantino's market, which is that a couple years ago now? I mean, I'm trying to think.
2014, I think.
2014. And so this was a case where, Mitch, why don't you just kind of remind the audience who's hearing this saying, wait, remind me what happened there. And then your thoughts about some of the conclusions that we might be careful not to overdraw from a Constantino story.
Sure. So I don't believe this funding exists anymore, but for a while there was a bucket of money called HFFI, the Healthy Food Financing Initiative. It was federal dollars that would go to really address food deserts. And they did so by providing grants and low interest loans to organizations or companies that wanted to start a grocery store in what is considered a food desert. So let me explain the what happened first, and then we'll go back and talk about the issues with it. So Constantino starts because a combination of Senator Schumer, the University of Rochester, who is developing College Town, and Action for a Better Community, who is the chosen nonprofit partner, probably because of the work they do in workforce development, got together, got some federal funding, and asked Constantino's, a small grocer from your hometown, as a matter of fact, to pop up here in Rochester on Mount Hope, which, by the way, in 2003, Wegmans had moved out of virtually the same exact location. And no offense to Constantino's, but as anyone who was reading the tea leaves at the time probably could have guessed, if it wasn't going to work for Wegmans in the city of Rochester, it probably wasn't going to work for Constantino's, who didn't have a supply chain here whatsoever. And sure enough, within 10 months, the store closed and now is, I believe, office space. So, you know, I think it's a very, very good way of examining what the issues are with a narrative of food desert and food swamp. In order to qualify for those dollars, all someone had to do was go onto the USDA's website and look at what they call, they have a food desert locator, a food desert map, I believe, type in some coordinates or a zip code and figure out, well, where's the food desert? What that doesn't account for at all is who lives there. What are the existing stores that are there? Are they small corner stores that are only selling really bad product? Are there farmers markets nearby? There's no real question of the quality or the content. It's only, is there a full line food service or supermarket in the area? And so they identified Mount Hope as one that was a food desert. But what we all know, anyone who knows Rochester well, is that there also isn't necessarily the density of population there to make a store work. And it really depended upon the university and their students and the hospital to make that store operate effectively. And it didn't. So what a food swamp does better as an analysis is it allows us to look at some of the nuances in the landscape of food retail, because it's not you either have a store or you don't. There's plenty of parts of this city, by the way, that have supermarkets that are not providing all the needs of the community. And you don't need to go any further than Northeast Rochester to be able to see that. And so, you know, what occurred in this situation was the city of Rochester brought in, not the city, but organizations brought in about $800,000 for Constantino's, and it was a total failure. And that's a pockmark on our ability, FoodLink and beyond, to bring in more federal dollars for programs like this. And it should we should require larger community-wide conversations about what can and can't work.
My concern is if we overdraw conclusions from that, then the food links and anyone else who wants to impact this issue going forward might be more limited, might be hamstringed by saying, well, we shouldn't do that again. Look what happened to Constantino's. Instead of saying, what were the fundamentals involved? Why did Constantino's happen? Why did we think that would work? And why should we have known it would fail? Is that fair?
Agreed. And I think a lot of people want to, they want to discredit the idea of food deserts or food swamps. And frankly, I don't care about the terminology. You know what? Let's throw it all out the window and let's just look at one very clear fact. And there's lots and lots of data that will back this up. The poorer you are, the higher your likelihood for a diet-related illness. That's true in rural communities. That's true in urban communities. And you can see it right now when you go to, you know, that part of Monroe Avenue, which has the flagship Wegmans, a Trader Joe's, and if they have their way, there'll be a Whole Foods there, right? All within a stone's throw of each other. Three of the best food retailers in the country within an eyeshot of each other. And yet you have huge swaths of the city and of rural communities, because keep in mind, this is not an urban issue. The town of Holly, New York doesn't have a grocery store. That's a big deal.
Yep.
But if you are poor living in one of those communities, you have a higher likelihood of diabetes, of obesity, of hypertension, heart disease, the list goes on and on.
You know, I would just add to why it shouldn't discredit the work that Foodlink is still working to do is, and Mitch touched on this, is that it's really important to, you know, call it what it was. And it was a for-profit grocery store. And as Mitch mentioned, if a for-profit grocery store could have succeeded there, it already would have been there. That's how the market works, right? And so there's other models, other opportunities for social purpose grocery stores, for nonprofits to operate that sort of entity. Because what a bricks and mortar, and that's really where you started at, is that grocery stores don't fix food deserts, because a bricks and mortar building doesn't get to the depths of what food insecurity is and what the symptoms of it are. And so if you really want to address that, you need to address community. You need to address the real barriers. You need to address affordability of fresh food. Constantino's did none of those things.
When you just mentioned a term, some of our listeners might have said, wait, I don't know if I've heard that before. Social purpose grocery stores. Let's define what that means. Are there examples you can point to?
Yeah, Mitch knows a little more about certain examples around the country that are in process right now. But essentially, it is a retail operation, but it's owned and operated by a 501c3, by a nonprofit charity, with the purpose of getting making sure that food is affordable, that it's good quality food, and with the ultimate goal of reducing food insecurity. So it's a retail operation. It has to make ends meet. It has the opportunity to obviously raise dollars as well through grants or public support, but is there with the express purpose of stretching people's food dollars. So it's truly an asset-based approach instead of the charitable food programs, which mm-hmm. look at what people don't have to spend. A program like this, a store like this, looks at what people do have in their pockets, the enormous amount of money that they already are spending on food, and how can we stretch that to make sure that their food doesn't just, their dollars don't just stretch for 2 weeks or 3 weeks of the month, but they can afford food for the entire month.
Okay.
Yeah. So the idea of a social purpose grocery has been tried a couple of times in different places. The terminology was actually started by a group in Toronto that Julie and I had a chance to meet with about a year ago at this point. And they wrote an excellent article. I'll share it with you. You can, you know, see if it's something you want to have a show about sometime down the line. But it's a really cool idea, and there are a couple examples. We went to Philadelphia to check out a store called the Fair and Square Market, which is actually run by the food bank there, which is the reason why we went, to try to figure out is this something that could be a long-term fit for the direction we're moving in. And, you know, they had a lot of struggles, a lot of challenges. But in the end, the store that they have right now is a store unlike any other in the whole area. It's actually outside of Philadelphia in a sort of city called Chester, Pennsylvania. And it's incredible, not just because of what they sell, but also what they do there. It's a community food resource center. People spend a lot of time in the supermarket. And if you make that market a place to get nutrition education, a place to have classes, a place to be able to share some community in a variety of ways, you can really make the store have more than, it's multifaceted. And it's working pretty well in Chester. Baltimore Salvation Army is about to open a grocery store, which I'm very curious to go down to. And I think there's lots of potential for this type of model to work in Rochester long term.
How does that compare to things like co-ops?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, my take on co-ops, and I'm no expert on it at all, but my take on co-ops are that a lot of this stuff is really about the worker owners, right? And the idea of the social purpose grocery is really about the end user. It's about keeping costs as low as possible. And, you know, we have a great co-op here. I like Abundance quite a bit, but I think it's fair to say that your average person who is using public assistance and is low income isn't going to be able to go into Abundance and shop regularly. So a social purpose grocery would be about using the nonprofit model to keep the price down, but providing the social service of having a grocery store that had fresh, affordable, convenient foods.
You're a member of City Council now. What is council's role in this, Mitch? What do you think government, local government, can do? Julia got a wry smile out of that question.
It's the only question he ever wants to be asked.
No, it's a really
I think it's important.
It is important. It's a really hard question, I'm not going to, you know, sit here and talk about all the specific details that I have, but I will tell you that the Rochester Public Market, which was built in 1904 with public dollars, is a real example of our city and our state, frankly, getting involved in the food retail landscape of the city of Rochester. And there's immense opportunities to take that same type of investment and find different ways to make eating healthy easier. And there's lots of examples of other cities doing a multitude of things to make living a healthy life easier. Because we know that you know, we understand social determinants of health. We understand environmental health. There has to be ways to change this stuff. And so some of them would be investing more in things like urban agriculture and community gardens. Certainly some of it would be investing in additional infrastructure for farmers markets. We have a lot of farmers markets that are wonderful in this city, but many of them are struggling. And how do we make them work, and how do we make them work for the people in those neighborhoods? That's work the city can certainly help with. And then, you know, lastly, what I would mention is that the city a couple years ago tried to work with corner stores, and they passed legislation about high impact or low impact stores. And what came back eventually was determined to not be legal. There were some lawsuits and this and that. But I don't think we give up there. I think that there's lots of ways to use the carrot and not the stick to really incentivize stores to start to carry healthier product. And we're seeing fruits of this already on Conkey Avenue, where a store that Julie and I started working with 9 years ago is now working with Common Ground Health and Project Hope, and is selling fresh smoothies and a lot of different fresh fruits and vegetables in there, because the store owner has the objective of doing that, because he understands it's the right thing to do. And he's being incentivized with some of the, you know, the work and the grant funding that Common Ground and Project Hope has. We need to utilize the carrot more to help store owners change their methods and think about investing in nonprofit-driven solutions.
Hmm. What do you hope, Julia, from, you know, I mean, someone like Mitch, who you've worked with for all these years with FoodLink, is now on City Council. What do you want government to do?
Yeah, I think, you know, I'm going to steal Mitch's phrase here. He talks about it a lot, and a lot of his research at University of Rochester pointed to that, but that food was once viewed as a public utility, same as water or electricity. And I think moving back toward that mentality is really critical. And Mitch is right. I think the carrot approach is probably a little more fruitful, no pun intended, in incentivizing some of these corner store owners or other nonprofits to in their programs that help build healthier communities, help increase access, whether that's through community agriculture or through programs like the curbside market, making it easier to operate, you know, the farmers market on wheels that we do. You know, I'm not also opposed to the stick as well. I think there is opportunity, you know, in terms of zoning to, I know a lot of it hasn't proved totally successful throughout the country, but to limit the amount of fast food, to try to change the landscape of beer, lotto, tobacco. I still think there's room to do that with a maybe more punitive measures.
Well, here's the conclusion from the Atlantic Monthly article, What to Do About Food Deserts, Food Swamps. I'm going to quote from them here. Quote, as a potential remedy, the food swamp study authors suggest counties could introduce zoning restrictions that would reduce the number of fast food joints while simultaneously increasing the number of grocery stores. But they should do so carefully. Los Angeles banned new fast food restaurants in a low-income part of the city in 2008, but the measure was considered a failure after obesity rates there continued to rise. New, healthier restaurants didn't enter the area, and since the ordinance only targeted standalone restaurants, strip mall restaurants were free to sling all the burgers and fries they wanted. If there's anything the food desert research shows, is that there's no one single silver bullet to fight health disparities. The food environment can contribute to poor health, as the grease-laden food swamps show, but changing it alone won't immediately reverse a community's health problems. End quote.
Yeah, this is the truth we live by. In other words, it's an incredibly complex issue. And absent of sweeping policy changes at the federal level, which is where it all starts from, really, the Farm Bill, if you know, corn, wheat, sugar, soy wasn't subsidized, if all the food produced in fast food and corner stores wasn't so cheap, we might not have as much of an issue on our hand. But absent of those policy changes, which of course we work towards, we look at what we can do at the local level. And so that's why all of our programs are integrated and looking at the complexities. So we often use sort of the butternut squash as the symbol of, you know, the example when we talk about the complexity of this. You know, there's an abundance of those grown in our region. Most people don't have access to them. If they do have access, if we pull up our curbside market and all of a sudden in October we have a whole lot of butternut squashes, we're there to show them what it is. We actually have nutrition educators on site to say, to teach them about the squash. Not only teach them, but to give them a recipe, maybe even to do a demo to show how they can peel the butternut squash, how they can, you know, cut it up, roast it. But then the question becomes, so now they have the knowledge, do they have a kitchen to prepare that butternut squash in? Do they have a knife that's sharp enough to cut it through it? So there's all these complex issues. So certainly getting rid of fast food stores alone, or fast food stores alone doesn't solve this. It's a much more complex issue. There's a lot of education that has to go into it. There's a lot of empowerment. There's a lot of community building and getting back to the kitchen. So there's no silver bullet. I would agree with that. And that's why FoodLink has such a diverse array of programs with one common link, and that is food.
I've become much more of a fan of delicata squash than butternut.
So
just
have
because
I.
Of the peeling.
Yeah, fair enough. It,
you know, but all under the same rubric, I understand the point there. Okay, so Mitch,
what
is there a zoning restriction possibility that city council could explore?
I'm 2 days on the job, so I'll have to you know, take a pass on that. But let me actually
You're dodging
add,
the question.
Let me
first
answer the
time
question
in
a different way.
Okay.
So even what the article says right there is that even if you have the zoning laws, what it says is that it doesn't help you attract the new healthier restaurants and stores. And I think that's a really key point here, is that grocery is low margin. Grocery is a very tough business, and especially with what's going on with Amazon and all. It's only going to get harder from here. So, sure, are there zoning restrictions to potentially prevent more fast food restaurants from piling up right at the Lyle-Mount Reed corridor that we drive down every day? I'm sure there are. Is that going to help attract healthier stuff? I don't think so for a moment by itself. And so we have to be conscious of that and think outside the box. This is one thing that really The Atlantic and, frankly, no one writing is doing this, is thinking outside of brick and mortar. Or even thinking outside of the private sector. And that's where this idea of a social purpose grocery comes in. But it's also where I come back to time and time again, thinking about the curbside market as a solution, not as a cute little program that runs and looks pretty, but as the solution to some of these problems. Because the curbside market right now, we go to about 100 sites per week, pretty much every public housing facility, every federally qualified health center. We are there at the same time, on the same day, every week, selling fresh, affordable produce conveniently, and also doubling people's SNAP dollars, which is key to all this, right? We're connecting federal incentive programs to double people's food stamp dollars to buy fresh food. One of the huge policy changes that I want to see happen, which is not something I can control in city council, but I'm actively fighting with the state on this, is to allow our curbside market, which is by far the biggest and best mobile market in this state, and I would say probably in the country too at this point, I wanted to be able to accept WIC benefits. That is a huge, huge opportunity. People talk all the time about SNAP and food stamps as the key public nutrition benefit. But WIC, which stands for Women, Infants, and Children, it's for pretty much any low-income mother, is a huge opportunity. And right now, it is so hard to be a store that accepts WIC benefits.
Why?
Because SNAP and WIC are the two major federal feeding programs, right? Or public assistance programs. SNAP is criticized all the time. The last time I was on your show, we were talking about the soda in the shopping cart, right?
Yep.
SNAP is criticized because you can really buy anything with SNAP, anything that's food, and therefore any store can really be able to accept it. WIC is really, it's a very good federal nutrition program because it's specifically for the foods that young mothers need for them and their children. And so you have to have products in the store like formula, like baby food, like baby meats as well. All these different things that most corner stores just don't have. So the reality is for a store to be able to accept WIC, you almost always have to be a big box. So Wegmans, Tops, Price Right, Walmart, they all accept WIC. But those are the stores that really don't exist in most of our city. If our curbside market could accept WIC, we could be going to the very places where we know there's lots and lots of young mothers, different housing facilities, and certainly different classes at hospitals, like some of the young mothers and centering pregnancy classes. And we could help people utilize their WIC dollars with the food right there on site. That is a creative, innovative solution that is so far outside the bounds of what the state thinks about or the federal government thinks about, because you've never had a mobile WIC vendor before. People are concerned about fraud.
Who controls making that change to WIC?
It's a federal program, but the states do have autonomy. So I'm currently working very closely with the state WIC department. I was appointed last year to the Governor's Council on Hunger and Food Policy. So I'm there on a biannual basis talking to them about how this is an absolute must if we want to increase WIC redemption rates. And, you know, those are the little solutions that I think can really make a big difference. And we just need the state to get a little bit of pressure. It won't even cost them much. It's about making sure that they have the right partners to trust in a pilot.
Okay. Let me grab a phone call. This is John in Rochester on the phone. Go ahead, John.
Hey, Evan. You know, it's ironic. I'm in Batavia. I just went through the McDonald's fast food window and got two fish fillets for $5. And I'll tell you, I like their fish fillets. But on a serious note, some of these large food corporations like McDonald's and others, why don't the government give them some subsidies in order to take advantage of their efficiencies in distributing foods? I think that has some merit. What are your thoughts?
Well, I don't think they need subsidies to do that work. I do think that you will see how you do see already that a lot of the fast food establishments are, I think, making some efforts to offer healthier products. Believe it or not, I've never eaten fast food because I grew up keeping kosher. And by the time I was a sentient being, I didn't want to eat fast food. So I don't know this for a fact. But I believe that most fast food places are selling sliced apples now, right?
I believe so. And like McDonald's, I don't want to do a commercial for McDonald's, but they have good breakfast menus also.
You're really liking on McDonald's.
Yeah. I'll tell you, you can't beat it when you're on the road a lot.
Well, I don't think that we need government subsidies to help these places. But we do need public drive and we need public advocacy to make sure that these menus have healthier foods on them. But I think ultimately, to the caller there, the bottom line is that these big giant corporations like your McDonald's out there, they only care about profit. It is not about they're not public health organizations. I frankly do not believe for a moment they care about anyone's health. They care about their bottom line. And that's what's going to dictate all their decisions.
Yeah. So go ahead, Julia.
I was just going to add that, you know, they are subsidized in the opposite end of the spectrum. The food that they are serving is what is subsidized by our farm bill. It is those same products that are incredibly cheap to produce. And you can sell them with a huge margin. And that is how, you know, that's the diet of the American family right now. That's where our taste buds go. And I would agree with Mitch that they don't require subsidies. They don't need subsidies to move to healthier food. However, changes in the farm bill could impact what shows up on their menu for sure.
Yeah. And so I would say to John, I mean, number one, Julia's point's a pretty strong one there, but they're already subsidized. Number two, that's a big company making a lot of money. And I just listened to Jim Gaffigan the other day talking about McDonald's. Jim Gaffigan making the point that all your friends claim they never go to McDonald's, and yet McDonald's sells 6 billion hamburgers a day. So as Jim Gaffigan says, I'm not good at math, but I think everybody's lying. So I think, to Mitch's point, think about this. How did McDonald's weather some of the changes in what sort of American food vogue, especially in the 90s and the aughts. Well, they added what they called veto items. A veto item is the kind of thing where if three or four friends are going out to grab lunch, but one of them only wants to grab a salad, they're going to veto McDonald's or Wendy's unless there's a salad. So McDonald's put salad on the menu to satisfy the veto person in a group. The problem is the salads often have more calories than some of the, you know, the burgers and other things. And they're not the healthiest, even though they fall under this rubric of quote-unquote healthy food. So I think the point is that for them, it's about money. There's already subsidy, and they're probably not going to be the arbiters of what is really going to be good for communities. They're out to serve themselves, which right. is fine. They're a company.
Ultimately, like if we could reframe this entire conversation, what we're talking about, whether it's with curbside market or whether it's with the social purpose groceries, or what Julia said initially about the public utility, it's about trying to take the profit out of food for a moment. And that doesn't have to be everywhere. Like there's a lot of, look, what's going on there in Pittsburgh with the Trader Joe's and the Wegmans and the possible Whole Foods, it's great. Give people all the options in the world to buy what they want. And if they have the money to go do it, so be it. But we have a legitimate public health crisis on our hands in poor communities. And the solution is not going to come exclusively from for-profit companies. It's proven to not work time and time again. We've privatized the food system completely, and the result is a very, very unhealthy populace.
All right. Julia, go ahead.
Yeah, I would say taking some of the profit out of the food and also adding back in the community. And one thing that should not be overlooked is that, you know, the Jim Gaffigan joke is probably true, right? Everyone goes there. Well, McDonald also creates a sense of community for people. That's what food does. It coalesces people. It brings them together. But can we do that with a different model? Can we disrupt the way that it's currently be done and bring it around healthy food and affordable food?
Yeah, I mean, we talked to a writer who travels around the country into some of the most struggling communities in this country. And he consistently says there are two places where people congregate the most, church and McDonald's. And he said, yeah. You know, any community that's really struggling, you go to their McDonald's and people are there. They're spending a lot of time there. They're meeting people there. They're talking. They're communing about what's going on in their places, in the places where they live. And so I think Julia's point's interesting. How do you move that? Because nothing wrong with people wanting to do that, and we can disparage McDonald's all we want, but there is a value there. How do we move that model into a place where there's healthier offerings, where people are doing that? So our guests are talking about ways to do this. It's Julia Tedesco, FoodLink Executive Director, and Mitch Gruber, who is FoodLink's Chief Program Officer and a new member of Rochester City Council. If you want to call the program, it's 844-295-TALK. 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. If you're eating a fillet of fish, please eat it before you call. But thank you, John. We appreciate the call. We'll get more of your feedback when we come back here after our only break on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Friday on the next Connections, the Buffalo Bills are back in the playoffs. We will talk Bills mania, but also the business of football. If you're a parent, would you let your kids play? As more information about CTE comes out, is it kind of gauche to keep watching the game? We'll talk about that and more. Then in our second hour, the music of the era, comparing the Obama and Trump administrations and popular music. Talk to you Friday. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Paul Whitehouse, Executive Director of 441 Ministries, writes to us to say, so glad for the show today. Since our inception, 441 Ministries has been moving in this direction. We've partnered with FoodLink to provide a summer farm stand. In 2016, we developed a community garden on Parcells Avenue, and we are hoping for a nonprofit grocery for a permanent solution. So great show. That's from Paul. Probably no surprise to hear.
A fantastic partner and a great reflection of what the power of food can be. They've continued to grow their programs year after year, and I think a major part of it is incorporating healthy food.
This is from David. He says, Evan, at one time, not that long ago, there were three City Wegmans locations, Mount Hope, Driving Park, and Midtown Plaza. The Mount Hope location had the opportunity to expand into a next-door CVS facility when CVS moved across the street. Instead, Wegmans closed that location, and the shopping center was turned into a parking lot. This was before College Town. It seems appropriate that Wegmans owes some small debt to the city in which they developed and could open city locations if for no other reason than to support the city. Wegmans started small and I believe could successfully run smaller stores again. David, no one from Wegmans is here to answer that question. But there's a member of city council. Do they owe any debt to the city to open and operate in the city, Mitch?
No, the answer is no. I think that Wegmans does owe a great deal to the city of Rochester in terms of being able to support lots of community agencies and a lot of the great nonprofit activities that happen here, and they do it in spades. And they help with a lot of different programs, but ultimately it's no one's job to say to a for-profit company like Wegmans, you must open a store that is not cost effective. And that's what, you know, you go back and read anything that came out of that their decision to close Mount Hope in 2003. It was right on the cover of City. I just was looking at it recently. They were losing money on that store. And so this is the larger point. It's not that Wegmans owes us, so they should build a store and they should lose money on it. It's that for-profit grocers are not always the answer. And there's other solutions. And now Wegmans should be part of those solutions. And they're in conversation with us all the time and really helped to build our new community kitchen, are making further investments in our curbside market. Those are our big things. But that in and of itself isn't enough, but nor is it appropriate to say they have to start a store that's going to lose money.
Yeah, both Wegmans Food Markets and the Wegman, you know, Family Foundation have invested millions of dollars to make sure that people in the city of Rochester have access to healthy food. And some of that is through food link initiatives, and some are through other initiatives. And they've certainly done their part in paying it forward in that respect. And as Mitch mentioned, they are hand in hand with us as we look at new initiatives and innovations in ensuring access to healthy food. But the bottom line is that, as we've said, is that the traditional grocery store, the traditional food retail outlet, is not solving the issue of food insecurity for a variety of complex issues. And another, you know, we don't just have to point to Constantino's. Our mentor, Tom Ferraro, and many other community advocates worked really, really hard to get a grocery store on Upper Falls Boulevard, you know, normal grocery store, normal retail operation. And while that was a win for the community, and I'm sure did bring a lot of positive things, it ultimately didn't lead to any systemic change. It certainly didn't impact BMIs or food insecurity rates. And a lot of that is because they need to make their margin. They can't subsidize fresh produce in that grocery store. And I would argue that they don't necessarily have the best selection either. So it's just another example in which the traditional model, the traditional food system, is not working, and we need to find ways to disrupt it.
Christy writes to the program and says, "Hello, Evan, Julia, and Mitch. I volunteer with a soup kitchen downtown, and I'm interested in your thoughts on ways that soup kitchens can help connect our guests to resources that provide a path out of food insecurity. I'm taking notes."
Yeah, it's a great question. I think there's a lot of things that can be done, and we expect and hope that every one of the agencies we work with, soup kitchens included, do offer wraparound services and referrals. And certainly part of that is by helping to refer people to SNAP benefits. By the way, let me make a quick plug. Sue Siegelman, Pam Johnson are the two NOEPs in the city of Rochester. And if anyone needs to contact them to help sign up for SNAP benefits, I will give the number at the end of the show. That's one type of referral. There's lots of others, obviously mental health, community health, health insurance. But the larger answer to your question is that we want to make sure that we're increasing employment, right? This goes hand in hand with what we just heard, actually, both in Mayor Warren's inauguration and in Governor Cuomo's State of the State. We heard a lot of talk about the need for workforce development and for employment. And one thing that we're in the middle of working on right now is starting a culinary food training, a food industry training program with opportunities for either culinary, warehouse, or food processing that can lead to lots and lots of jobs that are currently available in our community. We know the food industry has incredibly low barriers to entry. We know the food industry is one of the biggest in this area. And we know that there's lots of middle skill jobs today, tomorrow, and the next day that are available, and there's untrained people. So we hope to be sometime by the end of 2018 to have a fully operational workforce development program out of our kitchen, and to be able to allow soup kitchens like yourself to help us refer and recruit people.
Julia?
Yeah, despite all the talk about food deserts today or food swamps, the truth is our region is really a food mecca. We have an incredible agriculture industry, and then we have a place like Wegmans. We have manufacturers like Ledestri and Barilla and Kraft, and we have jobs in the food industry. And when you marry that with individuals who have been living in generational poverty and an organization like FoodLink that can link them, and this one-of-a-kind program that is doing just that, that is matching unfilled positions, middle skills, living wage jobs in the food industry with individuals currently living in poverty and training them for that, it's a win-win. And we will be recruiting individuals for that program and utilizing our partnerships with soup kitchens, pantries, other nonprofits throughout the region to get individuals into a program like that, because that truly is the ultimate solution to food insecurity.
Gary writes to the program and says, so if there's enough food, yet it's junk food and processed foods that manufacturers create that taste good, does having good, healthy food available matter without education? What is being done to educate people to choose better food so these social goods stores can compete?
Yeah, that's a great, great point. That's why we do, over 200 nutrition education classes every single month. We're out there. We have about 3 different unique programs where we're in the community, educating individuals, children, teen moms, refugees, you name it, how to eat healthy, how to shop healthy on a budget. Obviously, we need the food system to play its part to make the healthier option the easier option, the cheaper option in some senses, and that's a more complex issue. But there is a surplus of junk food. That's why, you know, we talk about the face of hunger. I think it's difficult for some people to understand how food insecurity shows up in America or shows up in Rochester. They don't see starving children, and that's often because of what we call the hunger obesity paradox, that children that are living in severe food insecurity often are also experiencing obesity or diet-related illnesses because of the plethora of junk food that's out there. And you're absolutely right. Swapping out the chips for the apple is not going to solve it without educating. So we go into schools, we go into soup kitchens, we're there in the community doing that back-end work as well, educating people and also empowering them to make the healthier choice.
Make no mistake about it, the education is a huge part of this, and we started a deficit. There is no more home ec, right? Home ec is gone from schools. It's not in the curriculum. We see a lot of kids, we see generational gaps in cooking in lots of families. There are just not as many opportunities to learn. So what we're trying to do as an organization is really invest in nutrition education programs. We have 9 educators on staff who run a multitude of different programs. There's also folks from Cornell Cooperative Extension in Monroe and Wayne County who run the Eat Smart New York program. There's also lots and lots of small organizations that do cooking here and there. But think about what else is going on. You see the food, how many food networks are there now? Are there multiple food networks? I don't even know. But there's lots of TV programming around food. It is something that we're starting to see changes in. We're starting to see a lot of people recognize the importance and the value of cooking and scratch cooking and fresh ingredients. But keep in mind that it was really, you know, I'm 32, was the generation that preceded me that loved super processed food, that took home ec out of classes, that really hurt and created the structural deficit that we're at right now. And it's going to take a while to dig ourselves out of that. But education is a huge part of all this stuff.
Well, here is a listener who is emailing the program to take up for McDonald's. I'm curious to know what our guests think. He says, I eat at McDonald's constantly, and when I worked outside, I could eat as much as I want. Now I have a desk job and I eat less. But personally, I believe more emphasis and kudos should be given to McDonald's. I read once that in the history of man, we have never been able to get as much nutrition for as little cost as we can with a McDonald's cheeseburgers.
Yeah, I think it depends on what you mean by nutrition, right? Certainly calories.
Calories, yes.
Yeah, I don't doubt that for a moment. Ultimately, I'm not someone who's going to sit here and say that what McDonald's has done for our country is a good thing. I think in the end, it prioritizes convenience, it prioritizes speed, and it devalues quality, and it devalues food, in my opinion. And I think it's much more important for us to think about how to make sure that people have a chance. Of course, what the gentleman is saying too, by the way, is exercise. It's the third part of the stool that we haven't really talked about. Also, of course, key to all this stuff. And I respect his opinion that when he was working outside, he could eat more than when he sat at a desk job. I agree with that. But McDonald's really had no part to play in that. And you must just have some incredible metabolism, sir. So congratulations.
Yeah, there's some truth to that. The cost per calorie way cheaper, right? This is an old statistic. So, you know, I don't know if it still holds up. But at one time, I know we understood an apple to be 8 times more expensive per calorie than a bag of chips. So I can only imagine how that compares to a Big Mac or whatever. There's a time and place for McDonald's, sure. I think it goes back to, again, that food oasis concept, that people deserve to live in neighborhoods where there's options, where there's not just a limitation. So McDonald's, fine. But when McDonald's is literally the only food outlet or the only place where you can afford to buy food, I think it becomes problematic.
Art writes to us and says, what about the Rochester Public Market? I was there today, even in the inclement weather, and there are plenty of vendors selling fresh produce in large quantities for extremely low prices. A lot of vendors take a form of public assistance, but even if they don't, this is a great way for anyone to stretch their dollars on real food 3 days a week all year.
No question. It is one of the greatest assets that our city has. It's an absolutely tremendous thing. And we should not forget, as Jim Farr always reminds me, that there were plenty of times over the last 100-some-odd years where the public market almost closed. And it's a real testament to the city that they kept it open time after time after time, no matter what threat it was under. And it is such an asset for our community. And it really is this food oasis, right? It is the most integrated space in our whole city. It is integrated racially, ethnically, and certainly socioeconomically. You can go buy a $9 loaf of artisanal bread, and you can buy Driscoll strawberries that fell off the truck and being sold for 50 cents. That's a good thing. We want that variety. And I agree. The only problem with the point the caller made is that the public market is not a solution to a city the size of Rochester by itself. I believe on its busiest days, the public market gets about 40,000 people in and out, which is really impressive. But we live in a metro area of well over a million. So that's not going to satisfy the problem on its own. It has to be part of the solution.
And if you just joined us, one of the things that our guests, Mitch Gruber and Julia Tedesco from FoodLink, have been talking about is their agreement that some of the solutions to, if you want to call it food desert or food swamp issues in our area, Rochester in particular, but certainly rural areas, et cetera, is the idea that if we just rely on the for-profit industry, that the results haven't been good. And that I don't hear Julia and Mitch blaming Wegmans or McDonald's or anybody for being a company that is for-profit to make money. That's okay. But their solutions are going to be driven by that instead of social good. And that's what they're looking at when it comes to social good going forward and some of these maybe new ideas for markets, groceries. So as we get ready to close the program, let's get a few thoughts from our guests on this. So Mitch, is there a recruitment effort that would have to happen in Rochester? Does council have a role in that? Or what do you think the process looks like we get to the point where we've got one or two or three in our region or in Rochester of these social good markets, these, I guess you'd call them social purpose groceries?
Yeah, I think we need to have a proof of concept. I think that's something that we have to make sure. And FoodLink is right now, we're doing a lot of the research behind this. We're working with a couple of different organizations, both locally and nationally, and trying to understand what the landscape is. Took a trip to Philadelphia, going to go down to Baltimore at some point and see what's going on there. And make sure that this is, because I don't believe that it's necessarily the solution quite yet either. We have to do some exploring. But what I really like to see happen is for us as a community to recognize that a project like a social purpose grocery, but more importantly in my mind, a project like the curbside market has an opportunity right now to fill a lot of the gaps in the food system. And one thing I hadn't talked about at this point was a couple years ago, we ran what we called the Community Store Initiative, which was our effort to work with two existing corner stores. And what we found was that these two stores, who we put a lot of work and effort into and made them into very nice stores that accepted WIC benefits, all the stuff we really wanted to. Ultimately, if we weren't the ones operating that store, which we weren't, it quickly tailed off because the store owners, especially in this city, most of our corner store owners are folks who really weren't even necessarily trained in business, right? The vast majority of our stores are immigrant owned. They're folks who come in. It's a pretty good way to make a living. But these aren't people who are ready to take the next step with their business. So we threw all the stuff at them and said, here, we have a perfect store now, let's do it. But they quickly fell back to old habits, which is, again, it illustrates the point that to move beyond these Band-Aid solutions, we need to think about not having the for-profit grocer involved. And the curbside market is one, the SPG is the other. You have my word, you have Julia's word that FoodLink will be working on that in the next couple of years for sure.
Okay, Julia?
Yeah, I think, you know, what FoodLink has become known for locally and across the country is that we're willing to innovate, we're willing to experiment, and we strive to be nimble. And that's because, as you mentioned earlier, there is no silver bullet, there is no sure thing. And so we're exploring a lot of options. You know, Mitch mentioned a proof of concept. I think we have that to some degree with the curbside market. We're now at over 100 stops every single week. We have people lining up waiting to access fresh fruit. There is a demand there, fresh fruits and vegetables. And it's been an incredibly successful program. So we know that if we bring food to these communities and that we bring it with a different model and that we bring education alongside of it and different programs, that it's going to begin to change communities. And anecdotally, we've heard from clients there that they've had to go off blood pressure medication, that they've lost weight. So we know that we can make a real impact. The question is how can we do more? And like we already mentioned, we're working with a lot of our community partners to figure out how to do that and, you know, where there's models across the country that we can bring to this area.
All right. Michael writes to the program and says, I volunteer every week on the curbside market truck. FoodLink is always looking for more volunteers to help with the program. The volunteers help make the program run. In return, they get an opportunity to directly help people in our neighborhoods.
Thank you for the segue. I was actually going to put you on the spot, Evan, and say you should come out and volunteer one morning. Check it out. See what you think.
I'll do it.
Maybe we'll do a program.
But what's the timing?
We'll work around your schedule.
I'll do it.
We'll make it work.
I absolutely
But it's really, it's a tremendous program. And what oftentimes gets overlooked in this community is how some of the work that we do at FoodLink is seen on a national level. And the curbside market at this point is now, I mean, we are asked on almost a weekly, certainly a monthly basis, to help consult with another organization in another city to develop a similar program. This is part of the solution. It's part of the future, is figuring out how to have public health interventions that are not necessarily out of a brick and mortar store. Not necessarily out of a hospital. And we're doing that right here. And the work of Michael and all the other volunteers is incredibly appreciated. If you want to find out more or to volunteer for any of the stuff that we do, foodlinkny.org is the place to go.
Foodlinkny.org. All right, I'll do it. How's that?
I'm on it.
Okay. Julia and Mitch from FoodLink, I really appreciate your time. And Mitch Gruber, one of the newest members of Rochester City Council, and ran for office on a platform with a number of prongs, but certainly this is a big part of his passion. So I know in office we'll see a lot of effort on this. And I hope you'll come back and tell us more about it.
Sounds good. Thanks for having me.
FoodLinkNY.org. Thank you, Julia. Great having you here.
Great to be here.
Julia Tedesco, the executive director. And I want to thank Rob Braden, the engineer, Megan Mack, producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Couldn't get through all your calls and emails. A lot coming in, but a lot of great stuff this hour. If you want to take a look at the article that inspired this conversation, we'll post it for you on our various platforms. Until tomorrow, have a great afternoon, and we will talk to you Friday on member-supported public radio.